We'll call our next case, which is case number 78259, Timothy Yandel versus the State of Nevada. We have Ms. Spells present with us representing the appellant, Mr. Chen representing the respondent. Ms. Spells, did you want to reserve any time in rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
How many minutes? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
5 minutes, please. 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. We will do so, and there'll be a little ding, you know, when you get to 5 minutes as a reminder then that. Okay, Ms. Spells, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Jasmine Spells, and I represent the appellant, Timothy Yandel. Today, I am going to focus my argument on two specific issues unless the court has additional questions. The state violated Yandel's constitutional rights by removing two African-American women from the jury, and additionally, count two, the robbery count, should be dismissed because it is redundant. The state's use of peremptory challenges to remove individuals from the jury is structural error and mandates reversal. The two removed jurors in this case fall under the protected class of both gender and race. By discriminatory removing these two jurors, the state violated Yandel's constitutional rights. Under step one of Batson, the court correctly found that Yandel made a prima facie case in this issue of discrimination. In this particular case, the state used 50% of their peremptory challenges to remove 66% of the black women that were on the panel. The state only exercised 4 peremptory challenges in this case, and they struck 3 women and 1 man, so 75% of women, of which 66% were black female adults. Although we didn't articulate this mathematical equation at the time of the trial, I think that it's very apparent and the court had the ability to see this based upon the fact that there were only 3 black women on the panel and the state used 2 of their peremptories out of 4 to get rid of 2 of them. Under step 2, the state did articulate race-neutral reasons. They indicated that juror 1213, Ms. Adams, that they got rid of her because she had been on a hung jury, and that juror 1186, Ms. Knight, that they believed that the juror would have sympathies towards the defense because her child was a sign interpreter.
Isn't that a well-recognized exception as far as a race-neutral reason? That's a well-recognized reason, isn't it? A hung jury? Somebody's been on a hung jury?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't discredit that. However, I think that it's significant here that that particular juror had also said on a criminal trial wherein which there had been a verdict. The state did not inquire as to the timing of those two cases or any additional factors. So that in and of itself alone, coupled with the fact that she had said on a jury where there had been a decision, I don't think is significant enough to be race neutral in this case. Here, Your Honor, under step 3, the court has to look at all of the relevant circumstances before making a ruling. And that's wherein the persuasiveness of the state's explanation becomes really relevant and important. It's relevant that 3 out of 4 of those strikes were used on women. It's also relevant here that there was disparate questioning with regard to the members of the panel. They did not question the two jurors in which they struck, being black woman jurors. Additionally, it's relevant, as we laid out in our briefing, the history of discrimination that has occurred throughout Batson challenges within the Clark County District Attorney's Office. And that's relevant because it shows a pattern and it shows a culture within the office. Additionally, under DiAmapo and Ford versus State, the court has held that where the state provides implausible and fantastic justifications for striking the jurors, that can be held as pretext for intentional discrimination. Here, the state's responses were both implausible and fantastic. The state did not engage in any meaningful questioning of these particular jurors. And failure to question about an area in which the state deems significant has been held as being pretext. So I don't believe here that the state really had a reason outside of pretext to use the peremptory strikes against these two individuals. It's significant, Your Honor, that, and this is detailed in our briefings, that with regard to juror 1213, she indicated that she had been the victim of mugging. She also stated that she could be fair and that she would follow the law, even if it differed from her own personal opinion. Additionally, she also had a child who was a correctional officer, which would lean towards bias towards the state, not towards the defense. Moving on to issue two, which is the fact that the robbery case should be dismissed because it is redundant. Here, the state argues that this should have been raised as a pretrial writ. However, we raise this as a constitutional issue. It's well-settled case law that constitutional issues can be raised at any time. Here, the court needs to look at the unit of prosecution with regard to the robbery. And significant is the construction of the statute. That's a question of law that must be reviewed de novo. The robbery statute indicates that the unlawful taking of personal property from the person of another or in the person's presence against his or her will by means of force or violence or fear of injury, immediate or future, to his or her person. Specifically, this crime punishes an unlawful taking by force or fear. The operative word in this statute is the taking. Alternatively, the plain language of this statute does not authorize a prosecution on a per victim or a per threat basis. If the legislature intended such, then they could have changed the way that the statute read and indicated that robbery is defined as the unlawful use of force or fear against the person to obtain or retain property. So it's very significant the way in which the statute is read and crafted. If the court finds that this statute is ambiguous, then the court needs to look at certain tools of statutory interpretation. And here, robbery is codified from the common law, so there is not any relevant legislative history on the matter. However,
Ms. Spells?
Yes?
I'm sorry, it's Justice Stiglitz. So how many people were robbed?
In this particular instance, we believe that one person was robbed. It's a very fact-specific situation, and the witnesses testified here that the defendant, Yandel, ran out of the Napa Auto Parts store. The store manager, Mr. Takakua, chased the defendant and followed him outside. Another employee by the name of Savari came afterwards. Specifically, he said that he did not go immediately with Takua. Takua testified that he caught up to the defendant, and at that time, the defendant raised his shirt and showed what he believed to be a weapon, that he brandished a weapon. Takakua turns around, and he says at that point, he sees his co-worker, who is at least one building away, close to the Napa Auto Parts store. Additionally, the witness, Ms. Cardona, says that only one employee ran towards Yandel, and she says that in Volume 3, page 794. And so here, our particular issue is that there's a conviction for an individual who is a witness instead of an actual victim of the particular crime. And the statute does not allow for everyone who is present to be a victim in this case. So based upon that, it's our contention that only one person would have been robbed, and that would have been Mr. Takakua.
Isn't that a question? Isn't that a question of fact, though, for the jury? I mean, you clearly argued that to the jury, so wouldn't that be a determination for them, not us?
No, Your Honor. It is a question of law because it is based upon the unit of prosecution. This court has found in many instances units of prosecution with regard to sex cases, and that is based upon a review of the statute itself. So it is an issue of law, not an issue of fact. I did want to point out that there are other jurisdictions who have ruled on the unit of prosecution with regard to robbery, and specifically they have indicated that the pertinent part of the statute is the taking, finding that where there is only one taking, there is only one robbery. And that is significant because those statutes are similar to our statute, and we did cite to those cases within our brief. Additionally, I want to point out that the Klein case, which both of us cited, is distinguishable here because in that particular case, The defendant did not raise the issue of the unit of prosecution. He only raised the issue of possessory interest. So I know in that case, the court found where there was one taking that there were two robberies, but the court did not consider a unit of prosecution argument in that case. So that case is completely distinguishable from the one at hand. Here, based upon the facts of the record as well as the law and the statute in and of itself, there can only be one robbery because there was just one taking. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Okay, Ms. Pelz, did you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. Just want to make sure I give you all that full time then. Okay, Mr. Chen, you may proceed.
Thank you. Alexander Chen, representing the respondent in this matter on behalf of the state of Nevada. Good afternoon, everyone. Clearly, Batson seems to be an issue this afternoon, and I would like to talk about that because I think it's important when we look at the cases that have to do with Batson and whether there's discrimination, we oftentimes look to the facts, we look to the record, and when you look at whether it's this court's rulings on Batson or whether you go to the United States Supreme Court cases on Batson, it's a very factual determination. I think everyone knows that there's three prongs to this test and that we consistently go through these three prongs, but the results and whether cases are upheld or overturned with regards to Batson often have to do with the facts of this case. So I do want to address the facts of this case because I do want to say that the words that are used in the record, they have to have meaning. So for instance, with regards to Ms. Adams, the African-American female juror, the first one that was struck, she said that she was part of a hung jury. That has to have meaning. As you all know and have worked at the trial levels, that question is a routine question for just about every single court that's doing voir dire. If that answer has no meaning, and as this court knows, we can't do a follow-up question to that. We can't ask, well, did you find them guilty or not guilty? We can't make that inquiry. So that means that the question itself has to have meaning, and if the question itself has meaning, then for the state to use that as a reason should be allowed and should overcome any type of pretext or any kind of assumptions about having a pretext to strike a juror based upon discrimination. And I would further just add, with regards to that, just as defense counsel and in their brief is doing on this particular matter, they're saying, well, Ms. Adams would have actually been a favorable state witness. What gives them that assumption? Well, they say that she has a correction officer's son. She was a victim of a crime. Therefore, she would have leaned towards the state. Certainly she might have, Your Honors. We'll never know. But at the same time, the reason that she got struck and the reason that was put on the record was plainly because she was part of a hung jury, and at that point, the state didn't find the need to inquire further. And I would say one more thing with regards to that. She happened to be an African-American juror who was on a hung jury. There was no other person for the state to question that was similarly situated, because that's one of the facts that this court has always looked at. So then we have to ask, okay, well, is this court trying to say at any point that because she's an African-American juror who was part of a hung jury, even if that's our reason for using our peremptory challenge, that we would then have to do further investigation and go above and beyond the reason that we were going to eliminate the person in the first place?
What do we?
It seems to me like
what
that
did
would
the court do with on review of this record when the state gives a reason for the juror whose daughter is an interpreter? She interprets. Okay. She's not hearing impaired. She just interprets.
Yes.
How does that jive with a witness who may be adverse to the state who happens to be hearing impaired?
Yes.
And that's the reason that's given, which seems to be a disconnect. What does the court do with that upon review?
Well, certainly it would be prong two of the race-neutral reasons. And the court actually does an inquiry. So although she does not say my findings are in those terms, she does make the inquiry as to what the state's saying. And the prosecutor gave a number of reasons. Now, I'd like to get to that.
Okay.
So there was a witness, Andrea Smith, who testified. This person was hearing impaired. And the person was the individual who's also part of the brief, subject to the brief of the Brady issues that defense or appellant is alleging. However, this person had a daughter who worked with individuals who were hearing impaired. Now, I understand that there's no necessarily direct causation, correlation.
Right, because she's not hearing impaired. She's just an interpreter.
She's not, Your Honor, but it's the same reason when we ask people, what's their job? What's their profession? What type of work do they do? Who do they work with? All of those type of things can play into the type of jury that either party's looking for. So in this particular case, the state felt that that witness was going to be a potentially adverse witness. To feel that somebody whose daughter works with a particular field of individuals, it's not outside the realm of possibilities that that person might have some additional sympathies that individuals who don't work with hearing impaired individuals might have. I think, Your Honor, I mean, for instance, just as an example, if my Asian individual, if my mom were on a jury, would people feel that I might have some sympathies towards an Asian woman who's on the jury just because they might have my mother? That's a little bit closer than perhaps what we have in this case, but my point is that when you look at why they did it and what their concern was, it's an absolutely race-neutral reason. Whether one agrees with it or not is up for debate, but I don't think that Batson has to do with whether it's agreeable or not. It just has to meet the burden of not being discriminatory and pretextually discriminatory. So in this particular case, that was something that they were concerned about. And I want to point out, too, when we're talking about the questions that were asked, if you read the entire transcript of jury selection, Mr. Alexis didn't ask many questions at all. He actually asked very few questions, and the ones that he did ask, only a couple of jurors actually raised their hands, and then he did some follow-up. Once he would ask those questions, he then went to, okay, choose to pass it to your left or right. So the state wasn't singling anybody out. The people that happened to speak were the ones that ultimately raised their hands to some of the questions, one of which was an African-American juror, which is in the record, and that person did remain on the jury. So upon the random questioning that happened, that juror was not stricken by either party and remained on the jury. And it also begs the question then, when we talk about the questions and looking at the inquiry of whether people had different questions or not, I think this court would realize that that's entirely, incredibly difficult to have the same questions asked of every single person. Not saying that individuals on both parties don't necessarily have voir dires where they ask the same questions of every single person. But oftentimes I think both parties, in trying to just go with the flow and trying to create some type of dialogue between the parties, will ask general questions and then have follow-up questions upon them. What I can say about this particular case is that the two jurors that were struck, and again, whether this court favors those reasons or not or believes in those reasons or not, they meet the burden set forth in Batson. And because of that, this case should not be reversed on any of those issues. With regards, then, to the robbery that was discussed, the case law on Hobson v. State is clear. These were two individuals, both who tried to follow this robber or to prevent him from taking property. Contrary to what appellant says, it's not the mere presence of those individuals. It's the fact that they had a possessory interest. Yes, Napa Auto Parts was the victim in this case, but part of that is having employees who manage and run the store. And on that day, there were these two individuals who were both present for the robbery, who were both part of the robbery that took place, since they both went outside and tried to stop this individual from leaving with the power inverters. So the case law is very clear with regards to that. But other than that, unless the court has any further questions, I'll yield the rest of my time.
Okay, Justice Silver.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What was wrong with the instructions of the defense, proposed instructions?
Aren't
they correct?
In theory, Your Honor. And the reason that I would say that is they made a very factual, specific instruction, or they proposed very factually specific instructions that had to do with Mr. Yandell, had to do with theories of their case. Those are all covered by other instructions. At least in my experience, and I think in most of the courts, they're using statements of law. They're not necessarily putting facts in the jury instructions themselves. I know this court has said to make specific instructions with regards to the cases so that we shouldn't just use generic instructions. But in this particular case, that exceeded the scope of what the jury should be instructed to.
That their theory, though, of the defense? Once again, they propose a theory of defense. Why aren't they entitled to put in their one or two instructions of their theory of defense? If it's a correct statement of law, and it is, clearly the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt identity, then I'm just not clear on what this objection is. Why constantly does the defense not get their theory in?
Because I would say that all of those instructions that they had, those theories were covered, Justice Silver. The phraseology, they wanted it in this particular way, but the court, as the neutral party, gave the instructions that covered each of the legal arguments. They were able to make their arguments. Nothing prohibited them from doing such a thing. So when we start getting into instructions that are factually specific to the case, I think that that's unnecessary.
But this one says one of the most important issues in this case is identification of the defendant as the perpetrator of the crime. This is a robbery. The prosecution has the burden of proving the identity of the perpetrator beyond reasonable doubt. How is that fact specific to just this case versus any robbery case?
Well, it's just as an example. I mean, that's a subjective belief. One of the most important. Everything in the case they would say is important. The state has to prove every material element, including the identity, beyond a reasonable doubt. So to make an argument that says one of the most important issues, I mean,
Mr. Chin,
yes.
Mr. Chin, I mean, we've empowered the judges and obligated the judges then to make it a correct statement. So they could have said an issue in this case. They could have just stricken one of the most important issues and said an issue in this case is the identification of the defendant as a perpetrator.
They could have, but that wasn't proposed, Justice Stiglitz. Do they have authority?
Yeah, doesn't the court have an obligation to try to make these correct, to try to get these instructions out?
But this is a defense-proposed instruction, and the reason I'm pointing that out is one of the things that, for instance, we're arguing here today is units of prosecution and how many robberies there can be. So if one of the most important issues in this case is the identity...
But that could have been stricken. Identity was their defense. Their defense is, no matter how many people allegedly got robbed, it wasn't my guy. So their theory of the case is identity, wrong guy, right? So why don't they have as much of I think we've said they have a right to have their theory of the case instructed upon or inverse instructions. And yet consistently the courts don't give them. And frankly, they're almost always going to be covered by other instructions. So we've kind of created this opportunity and this right without any remedy. So what was the problem inherently if these were given or corrected? Why not give them?
Well, I think I would stick by saying that one of the issues, who's to judge, first of all, what's most important, for instance? So this is a defense proposed instruction. Could the court have changed it and said an issue is? Of course, it could theoretically, but we're talking about that instruction was covered. Instruction 6, I believe, was one of the ones that covered that specific issue with identity. So,
but you agree they have a right to a pinpoint instruction. I mean, they should be given. They have a right to get a pinpoint instruction or a theory of defense instruction. Agreed?
Absolutely, they get a theory per Crawford.
But we always come down to, but if the court doesn't give it. So what? Because it's covered in other instructions, right?
Well, I think that matters, but I also think it's what's proposed, Justice Stiglitz. In this one, if they want that particular instruction, what if they had given it and now would be arguing, or later would be arguing, oh, this is some type of ineffective thing because we ineffective assistance of counsel because we mistakenly said that there was only one important issue, but really the most important issue was whether they could even convict him of more than one robbery. I mean, therein lies the problem, and that's why I think most parties try to have general statements and correct statements of the law, and certainly defense gets their theory of the case. They had their theory of the case in this.
Where's their theory of the case in the instructions? What instruction can they hold up to the jury, you know, with their theory of the case? You've got a whole bunch.
We have to, well, the theory, if it has to do with identity, is that we have to prove that the defendant is the person who committed the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is an instruction. So perhaps this court will give clarity in terms of that, but I think that it's very different to start making factual, specific ones, not just theories of the case, but what they had here.
But for instance, if somebody, you're rebelling against facts a bit, I mean, if an issue in the case resolved upon a fact, say it was use of a firearm,
yes,
and they wanted a pinpoint instruction that says if they don't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, Mr. Blah-de-blah used a firearm, you must find him not guilty on that or find that not true. I mean, what would be the problem with that?
In that particular scenario and under those facts, Your Honor, there might not be.
Okay.
But I would still think that if this court is concerned about that, that is not error that would be warranting of reversing this case.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chen, very much. Any further questions for Mr. Chen from the justices? If not, okay, thank you, Mr. Chen. Elizabeth in Carson City, would you add an extra 30 seconds to Ms. Bell's rebuttal time since we ran slightly over and we need to even the time out here for each side? And Ms. Bells, you may proceed with your rebuttal argument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, justices. So, with regard to the Batson issue, it's important to understand the history of that case. And the court has ruled that even striking one juror for a racial reason violates equal protection clause. So the fact that another juror wasn't paneled is not a relevant inquiry as to whether or not there was a discriminatory practice with regard to the state's use of peremptory challenges. Additionally, not asking every possible juror the same question is not the same as not asking the jurors who you intend to use your peremptory challenges on absolutely no questions at all. The courts have given us direction, and with that direction, we are to look at the comparative analysis as to how individuals of a different race answered similar questions versus the individuals of the race or gender or protected class that were struck. And here, specifically where the state alleges these race-neutral reasons, which are mere speculation, it's significant that they did not ask any follow-up questions. The record is void as to the relationship that the juror had with her daughter that is a sign interpreter. There's no inquiry as to whether or not they have a cordial relationship. They could be estranged. And so to make an assumption that simply because this individual has a daughter who works with hearing-impaired individuals, is not hearing-impaired herself, that she will therefore not be fair and impartial is just that. It's rank speculation. It's a mere assumption. The court has also stated...
Ms. Spells,
yes.
Before you go on, do you agree here that the court, as to the third prong, although you may disagree with their final conclusion, that the court, in fact, made an inquiry, asked questions, and made findings. Whether you disagree with those findings or not may be a different issue. But do you agree that the court discharged its duty under prong three to analyze these or ask questions or satisfy itself?
I do believe that the court exercised in prong three and that the court did ask specific questions. I do not believe that the court made any specific findings, and I don't think that there was really any inquiry with regard to pretext. The court in Batson said that if any facially neutral reason is sufficient, then the law would not be much more than what it was in Swain. And under Swain, there is a requirement that the defense show that the preempts were both discriminatory, but also that there was an ongoing pattern of discrimination. And so Batson attempted to change that because it was so difficult to show that ongoing pattern. So here, I don't think that just throwing out a facially neutral reason is sufficient enough. I want to talk about the defense proposed jury instructions, Your Honor, and the case law is very clear under Crawford that the defense is allowed to have a jury instruction on their theory of the case. And in doing that, they are to do a jury instruction that references applicable legal principles that are specifically tailored to the facts and circumstances of the case. So I don't believe that we should have jury instructions that are completely void of any factual references. They are supposed to be specific to that particular case because the jurors are judging that case. They're not judging every other case in front of them. Additionally, I do believe that the court could have made a changing if there was an issue with regard to the statement, one of the most important issues that very well could have been changed, but there was no work done to make any changes to any of the defense proposed jury instructions. With regard to the robbery issue, we are not arguing possessory interest. I would point out that Hobson does talk about possessory interest. The argument here is that the second employee, Savari, is a mere witness. His possessory interest would not matter because, one, there's only one taking, but additionally, there's only one use of threat or force. And so there are many elements with regards to robbery, and our statute is very ambiguous. It does not identify specifically what the unit of prosecution is. Here we have one taking. The pertinent part of our statute references the unlawful taking. Therefore, there should just be one robbery. But even if the court finds that that is not the correct unit of prosecution and that it should be a combination of things, perhaps the taking with regard to the use of force and possessory interest, then here there's still only one use of force. The other individual is not close enough to have that use of force applied to him. He is a mere witness. He is buildings away behind Mr. Takakua. And that's significant because basically if we say that everyone who has possessory interest who is within the ability to see this occur but is not threatened, nothing is done particularly to their person, and there's a robbery, then that leads to absurd results. Therefore, that is significant. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Spells. Thank you, Mr. Chen. Thank you both for your excellent arguments and briefs on this case. And we will take the case under submission at this time. And the court will be in recess till 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Justices. Okay.